Chapter 18. Sorcerers and Apprentices. The Natural Sciences. Do you think there is a place for philosophy in today's world? Of course, but only if it is based on the current state of scientific knowledge and achievement. Philosophers cannot insulate themselves against science. Not only has it enlarged and transformed our vision of life and the universe enormously, it has also revolutionized the rules by which the intellect operates. Claude Levi-Strauss. The standard text in gas dynamics, written by its author while on a Guggenheim fellowship, has been described by him as having had its form dictated by the needs of industry. Within this framework, confirming Einstein's theory of general relativity came to be seen as a critical step forward, improving ballistic missile accuracy by accounting for minute gravitational effects. Increasingly, post-war physics narrowed its concentration into those areas thought to have military applications. Margaret Jacob. 1. No period in history has been more penetrated by and more dependent on the natural sciences than the 20th century. Yet no period since Galileo's recantation has been less at ease with it. This is the paradox with which the historian of the century must grapple. But before I try to do so, the dimensions of the phenomenon must be recognized. In 1910, all the German and British physicists and chemists put together amounted to perhaps 8,000 people. In the late 1980s, the number of scientists and engineers actually engaged in research and experimental development in the world was estimated at about 5 million, of whom almost 1 million were in the USA, the leading scientific power, and a slightly larger number in the states of Europe. Though scientists continued to form a tiny fraction of the population, even in the developed countries, their numbers continued to rise quite dramatically, more or less doubling in the 20 years after 1970, even in the most advanced economies. However, by the late 1980s, they formed the tip of a much larger iceberg of what could be called potential scientific and technological manpower, which essentially reflected the educational revolution of the second half of the century. It represented about 2% of the global population and perhaps 5% of the North American population. The actual scientists were increasingly selected by means of an advanced doctoral thesis, which became the ticket of entry to the profession. In the 1980s, the typical advanced Western country generated something like the 130 to 140 such science doctorates per year for each million of its inhabitants. Such countries also spent, mainly from public funds, even in the most capitalist countries, quite astronomic sums on such activities. Indeed, the most expensive forms of big science were beyond the scope of any single country, except, until the 1990s, the USA. There was, however, one major novelty. In spite of the fact that 90% of scientific papers, whose numbers doubled every 10 years, appeared in four languages, English, Russian, French and German, Eurocentric science ended in the 20th century. The age of catastrophe, and especially the temporary triumph of fascism, transferred its centre of gravity to the USA, where it has remained. Between 1900 and 1933, only 7 science Nobel Prizes were awarded to the USA. But between 1933 and 1970, 77. The other countries of European settlement also established themselves as independent centres of research. Canada, Australia, the often underrated Argentina, though some, for reasons of size or politics, exported most of their major scientists, New Zealand, South Africa. At the same time, the rise of non-European scientists, especially those from East Asia and the Indian subcontinent, was striking. Before the end of the Second World War, only one Asian had won a science Nobel Prize, C. Raman in physics, 1930. Since 1946, such prizes have been awarded to more than 10 workers with obviously Japanese, Chinese, Indian and Pakistani names, and this clearly underestimates the rise of Asian science as much as the pre-1933 record underestimated the rise of US science. However, at the end of the century, there were still parts of the world which generated notably few scientists in absolute terms and even more markedly in relative terms, for example, most of Africa and Latin America. Yet it is a striking fact that at least a third of the Asian laureates do not appear under their own country of origin but as US scientists. Indeed, of the US laureates, 27 are first-generation immigrants. For, in an increasingly globalized world, the very fact that the natural sciences speak a single universal language and operate under a single methodology has paradoxically helped to concentrate them in the relatively few centers with adequate resources for their development, that is to say, in a few highly developed rich states, and above all, in the USA. The brains of the world, which in the age of catastrophe fled from Europe for political reasons, have since 1945 drained from poorer to richer countries, mainly for economic ones. This is natural, since in the 1970s and 1980s, the developed capitalist countries spent almost three-quarters of all the world's outlays on research and development, whereas the poor countries, developing, spent no more than 2-3%. Yet even within the developed world, science gradually lost dispersion, partly because of the concentration of people and resources for reasons of efficiency, partly because the enormous growth in higher education inevitably created a hierarchy, or rather an oligarchy, among its institutes. In the 1950s and 1960s, half the doctorates in the United States came from the 15 most prestigious university graduate schools, to which the ablest young scientists consequently flocked. In a democratic and populist world, scientists were an elite, concentrated in a relatively few subsidized centers. As a species, they occurred in groups for communication. Someone to talk to was central to their activities. As time went on, these activities became ever more incomprehensible to non-scientists, though laymen tried desperately to understand, with the help of a large literature of popularization, sometimes written by the best scientists themselves. Indeed, as specialization grew, even scientists increasingly required journals to explain to each other what was happening outside their own field. That the 20th century depended on science hardly needs proof. Advanced science, that is to say, the kind of knowledge which could neither be acquired by everyday experience, nor practiced, nor even understood, without many years of schooling, culminating in esoteric postgraduate training, had only a comparatively narrow range of practical applications until the end of the 19th century. The physics and mathematics of the 17th century governed the engineers, while by the middle of Victoria's reign, chemical and electrical discoveries of the late 18th and early 19th centuries were already essential to industry and communications, and the explorations of professional scientific researchers were recognized as the necessary spearhead of even technological advance. In short, science-based technology was already at the core of the 19th century bourgeois world, even though practical people did not quite know what to do with the triumphs of scientific theory, except in suitable cases to turn them into ideology, as the 18th century had done with Newton and the late 19th century did with Darwin. Nevertheless, vast areas of human life continued to be ruled by little more than experience, experiment, skill, trained common sense, and, at most, the systematic diffusion of knowledge about the best available practices and techniques. This was plainly the case in farming, building, and medicine, and indeed over a vast range of activities which supplied human beings with their needs and luxuries. Sometime in the last third of the century, this had begun to change. In the age of empire, not only do the outlines of modern high technology begin to be visible, one only has to think of automobiles, aviation, radio and film, but so do those of modern scientific theory, relativity, the quantum, genetics. Moreover, the most esoteric and revolutionary discoveries of science were now seen to have immediate technological potential, from wireless telegraphy to the medical use of X-rays, both based on discoveries of the 1890s. Nevertheless, while the high science of the short 20th century was already visible before 1914, and while the high technology of the later century was already implicit in it, high science was not yet something without which everyday life everywhere on the globe was inconceivable. This is the case as the millennium draws to its close. As we have seen, technology based on advanced scientific theory and research dominated the economic boom of the second half of the 20th century, and no longer only in the developed world. Without state-of-the-art genetics, India and Indonesia could not have produced enough food for their exploding populations. And by the end of the century, biotechnology had become a significant element in both agriculture and medicine. The point about such technologies is that they were based on discoveries and theories so far from the world of the ordinary inhabitant of even the most sophisticated of developed countries that barely a few dozen, or at most, a few hundred persons in the world could initially grasp that they had practical implications. When the German physicist Otto Hahn discovered nuclear fission in 1937, even some of the scientists most active in the field, such as the great Niels Bohr, 1885 to 1962, doubted that it had practical applications in peace or war, at all events for the foreseeable future. And if the physicists who understood its potential had not told their generals and politicians, these would certainly have remained in ignorance, unless they were themselves postgraduate physicists, which was very unlikely. Again, Alan Turing's celebrated paper of 1935, which was to provide the foundation of modern computer theory, was originally written as a speculative exploration for mathematical logicians. The war gave him and others the occasion to translate theory into the beginnings of practice for the purpose of code-breaking. But when it appeared, nobody except a handful of mathematicians even read, let alone took notice of Turing's paper. Even in his own college, this clumsy-looking, pale-faced genius, then a junior fellow with a taste for jogging, who posthumously became a sort of icon among homosexuals, was not a figure of any prominence, at least I do not remember him as such. Even when scientists were plainly engaged in trying to solve problems of acknowledged capital importance, only a small huddle of brains in an isolated intellectual corner recognized what they were up to. Thus, the present author was a fellow of a Cambridge college at the very time when Crick and Watson were preparing their triumphant discovery of the structure of DNA, the double helix, immediately recognized as one of the crucial breakthroughs of the century. Yet, though I even recall meeting Crick socially at the time, most of us were simply not aware that these extraordinary developments were being hatched within a few tens of yards of my college gates, in laboratories we passed regularly and pubs where we drank. It was not that we took no interest in such matters. Those who pursued them simply saw no point in telling us about them, since we could not have contributed to their work, or probably even understood exactly what their difficulties were. Nevertheless, however esoteric and incomprehensible the innovations of science, once made, they were almost immediately translated into practical technologies. Thus, transistors emerged as a byproduct of researches in solid-state physics, that is to say, the electromagnetic properties of slightly imperfect crystals, in 1948. Their inventors were given Nobel Prizes within 8 years. As did lasers, 1960, which came not from optical studies but from work to make molecules vibrate in resonance with an electric field. Their inventors were also quickly recognized by Nobel Prizes, as was, belatedly, the Cambridge and Soviet physicist Peter Kapitsa, 1978, for work in low-temperature physics which produced superconductors. The experience of wartime research in 1939 to 1946, which demonstrated, at least to the Anglo-Americans, that an overwhelming concentration of resources could solve the most difficult technological problems within an improbably short time, encouraged technological pioneering, regardless of cost, for purposes of war or national prestige, for example, the exploration of cosmic space. This, in turn, accelerated the transformation of laboratory science into technology, some of which proved to have a wide potential for everyday use. Lasers are an example of this speed. First seen in the laboratory in 1960, they had, by the early 1980s, reached the consumer in the form of the compact disc. Biotechnology was even quicker off the mark. Recombinant DNA techniques, that is to say, techniques for combining genes from one species with those of another, were first recognized as adequately practicable in 1973. Less than 20 years later, biotechnology was a staple of medical and agricultural investment. Moreover, thanks largely to the astonishing explosion of information theory and practice, new scientific advances were translated, with ever-diminishing time lags, into a technology that required no understanding whatever by the end users. The ideal result was an entirely idiot-proof set of buttons or a keyboard which only required pressing in the right places to activate a self-acting, self-correcting, and, so far as possible, decision-taking procedure which required no further inputs from the limited and unreliable skills and intelligence of the average human being. Indeed, ideally the procedure could be programmed to do without human intervention entirely, except when something went wrong. The supermarket checkout of the 1990s typified this elimination of the human element. It required no more of the human operator than to recognize the notes and coins of the local currency and to key in the quantity offered by the customer. An automatic scanner translated the barcode on the purchase into a price, added up all the purchase prices, deducted the total from the amount offered by the customer, and told the operator how much change to give. The procedure for ensuring the performance of all these activities is extraordinarily complex, resting as it does on a combination of enormously sophisticated hardware and very elaborate programming. Yet unless or until something went wrong, such miracles of late 20th century scientific technology required no more of the operators than the recognition of the cardinal numbers, a minimal attention span, and a rather greater capacity for concentrated tolerance of boredom. It did not even require literacy. So far as most operators were concerned, the forces which told them to inform the customer that he or she had to pay £2.15 and instructed them to offer £7.85 as change for a £10 note were as irrelevant as they were incomprehensible. They did not have to understand anything about them to operate them. The sorcerer's apprentice no longer had to worry about his or her lack of knowledge. For practical purposes, the situation of the supermarket checkout operator represented the human norm of the late 20th century. The operation of miracles of avant-garde scientific technology, which we do not need to understand or modify, even if we know or think we know what is going on. Someone else will do or has done it for us. For even if we suppose ourselves to be experts in one special field or another, that is to say, the sort of person who could put the device right if it went wrong or could design or construct it, faced with most of the other everyday products of science and technology, we are ignorant and incomprehending laymen and laywomen. And even if we were not, our understanding of what makes the thing we use work and of the principles behind it is largely irrelevant knowledge, as the technical process for manufacturing playing cards is to the honest poker player. Fax machines are designed to be used by people who have no idea why the machine in London reproduces a text fed into it in Los Angeles. They do not function better when operated by professors of electronics. Thus, science, through the technology-saturated fabric of human life, demonstrates its miracles daily to the late 20th century world. It is as indispensable and omnipresent, for even the remoter corners of humanity know the transistor radio and the electronic calculator, as Allah is to the pious Muslim. We may debate when this capacity of certain human activities to produce superhuman results became part of the common consciousness, at least in the urban parts of developed industrial societies. It certainly did so after the explosion of the first nuclear bomb in 1945. However, there can be no doubt that the 20th century was the one in which science transformed both the world and our knowledge of it. We should have expected the ideologies of the 20th century to glory in the triumphs of science, which are the triumphs of the human mind, as the secular ideologies of the 19th century had done. Indeed, we should have expected even the resistance of traditional religious ideologies, the great redoubts of 19th century resistance to science, to weaken. For not only did the hold of traditional religion slacken over most of the century, as we shall see, but religion itself became as dependent on high science-based technology as any other human activity in the developed world. At a pinch, a bishop or imam or holy man in the 1900s could have conducted their activities as though Galileo, Newton, Faraday or Lavoisier had not existed, that is to say, on the basis of 15th century technology. And such 19th century technology has raised no problems of compatibility with theology or holy texts. It became far harder to overlook the conflict between science and holy writ in an age when the Vatican was obliged to communicate by satellite and to test the authenticity of the Turin Shroud by radiocarbon dating. When the Ayatollah Khomeini spread his words from abroad into Iran by means of tape cassettes, and when states dedicated to the laws of the Quran were also engaged in trying to equip themselves with nuclear weapons. The de facto acceptance of the most sophisticated contemporary science via the technology which depended on it was such that in fin de siècle New York, the sales of super high-tech electronic and photographic goods became largely the speciality of Hasidim, a brand of Eastern Messianic Judaism chiefly known, apart from their extreme ritualism and insistence on wearing a version of 18th-century Polish costume, by a preference for ecstatic emotion over intellectual inquiry. In some ways, the superiority of science was even accepted officially. The Protestant fundamentalists in the USA, who rejected the theory of evolution as unscriptural, the world having been created in its present version in 6 days, demanded that Darwin's teaching should be replaced or at least countered by the teaching of what they described as creation science. And yet, the 20th century was not at ease with the science which was its most extraordinary achievement and on which it depended. The progress of the natural sciences took place against a backdrop glow of suspicion and fear, occasionally flaring up into flames of hatred and rejection of reason and all its products. And in the undefined space between science and anti-science, among the searchers for ultimate truth by absurdity and the prophets of a world composed exclusively of fictions, we increasingly find that characteristic and largely Anglo-American product of the century, and especially of its second half, science fiction. The genre anticipated by Jules Verne, 1828-1905, was initiated by H.G. Wells, 1866-1946, at the very end of the 19th century. While its more juvenile forms, such as the familiar TV and widescreen space westerns with cosmic capsules as horses and death rays as six-shooters, continued the old tradition of fantastic adventures with high-tech gadgets, in the second half of the century, the more serious contributions to the genre veered towards a gloomy or at least an ambiguous view of the human condition and its prospects. The suspicion and fear of science was fueled by four feelings: that science was incomprehensible, that both its practical and moral consequences were unpredictable and probably catastrophic, and that it underlined the helplessness of the individual and undermined authority. Nor should we overlook the sentiment that, to the extent that science interfered with the natural order of things, it was inherently dangerous. The first two feelings were shared by both scientists and laymen. The last two belonged mainly to outsiders. Lay individuals could only react against their sense of impotence by seeking out things which science could not explain, along the lines of Hamlet's, "There are more things on heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy," by refusing to believe that they could ever be explained by official science, by hungering to believe in the inexplicable because it seemed absurd. At least in an unknown and unknowable world, everyone would be equally powerless. The greater the palpable triumphs of science, the greater the hunger to seek the inexplicable. Shortly after the Second World War, which culminated in the atom bomb, Americans, 1947, later followed as usual by their cultural followers the British, took to observing the mass arrival of unidentified flying objects, plainly inspired by science fiction. These, it was firmly believed, came from extraterrestrial civilizations different from and superior to ours. The more enthusiastic observers had actually seen their strangely shaped denizens emerging from these flying saucers, and one or two even claimed to have been given rides by them. The phenomenon became worldwide, although a distribution map of the landings of these extraterrestrials would show a heavy preference for landing on or circling over Anglo-Saxon territories. Any scepticism about UFOs was put down to the jealousy of narrow-minded scientists helpless to explain phenomena beyond their narrow horizons, perhaps even to a conspiracy of those who kept the common man in intellectual bondage to conceal superior wisdom from him. These were not the beliefs in magic and miracles of traditional societies, for which such interventions in reality were part of very incompletely controllable lives, and much less amazing than, say, the sight of an airplane or the experience of speaking into a telephone. Nor were they part of the universal and permanent fascination of human beings with the monstrous, the freakish, and the marvellous, to which popular literature bears witness since the invention of printing, from broadsheet woodcut to US supermarket checkout magazine. They were a rejection of the claims and the rule of science, sometimes consciously so, as in the extraordinary and once again US-centred rebellion of fringe groups against the practice of putting fluoride into the water supply after it had been discovered that an intake of this element would dramatically reduce dental decay in modern urban populations. It was passionately resisted not merely in the name of the freedom to choose carries, but by its more extreme opponents as a dastardly plot to enfeeble human beings by compulsory poisoning. And in this reaction, vividly brought to life in Stanley Kubrick's film Dr. Strangelove, 1963, suspicion of science as such merged with fear of its practical consequences. The built-in valetudinarianism of North American culture also spread such fears, as life was increasingly submerged by modern technology, including medical technology, with its risks. The unusual fondness of the USA for letting litigation answer all matters in human dispute allows us to monitor these fears. Did spermicides cause birth defects? Did electric power lines cause medical harm to people who lived near them? The gap between experts who had some criterion for judgment and laypersons who had only hope or fear was widened by the difference between dispassionate assessment, which might well judge a small degree of risk to be a price worth paying for a large degree of benefit, and individuals who understandably desired zero risk, at least in theory. In effect, such fears were the fears of the unknown menace of science by men and women who only knew that they lived under its dominion. Fears whose intensity and focus differed according to the nature of their views and fears about contemporary society. However, in the first half of the century, the major hazards to science came not from those who felt humbled by its unlimited and uncontrollable powers, but from those who thought they could control them. The only two types of political regimes, apart from the then rare reversions to religious fundamentalism, which interfered with scientific research on principle, were both deeply committed to technical progress without limit, and in one case, to an ideology which identified it with science and hailed the conquest of the world by reason and experiment. Yet in different ways, both Stalinism and German National Socialism rejected science even as they used it for technological purposes. What they objected to was its challenge to world views and values expressed in a priori truths. Thus, neither regime felt at ease with post-Einsteinian physics. The Nazis rejected it as Jewish, and the Soviet ideologists as insufficiently materialist, in Lenin's sense of the word, though both tolerated it in practice, since modern states could not do without the physicists who were post-Einsteinians to a man or woman. The National Socialists, however, deprived themselves of the flower of continental Europe's physical talent by driving Jews and ideological opponents into exile, incidentally destroying the early 20th century German scientific supremacy in the process. Between 1900 and 1933, 25 out of 66 Nobel Prizes in physics and chemistry had gone to Germany. But since 1933, only about 1 in 10. Neither regime was in tune with the biological sciences either. Nazi Germany's racial policies horrified serious geneticists who, largely because of racists' enthusiasm for eugenics, had begun after the First World War to put some distance between themselves and policies of human genetic selection and breeding, which included the killing of the unfit, although it must be sadly admitted that there was a good deal of support for National Socialist racism among German biologists and medical men. The Soviet regime under Stalin found itself at odds with genetics, both for ideological reasons and because state policy was committed to the principle that, with sufficient effort, any change was achievable, whereas science pointed out that, in the field of evolution in general and agriculture in particular, this was not the case. In other circumstances, the controversy among evolutionary biologists between the followers of Darwin, for whom inheritance was genetic, and those of Lamarck, who had believed in the inheritance of characteristics acquired and practiced during a creature's lifetime, would have been left to be settled in seminars and laboratories. Indeed, it was regarded by most scientists as settled in favour of Darwin, if only because no satisfactory evidence for the inheritance of acquired characteristics had ever been found. Under Stalin, a fringe biologist, Trofim Denisovich Lysenko, 1898-1976, won the support of the political authorities with the argument that farm output could be multiplied by Lamarckian procedures which short-circuited the relatively slow process of orthodox plant and animal breedings. In those days, it was unwise to disagree with authority. Academician Nikolai Ivanovich Vavilov, 1885-1943, the most famous of Soviet geneticists, died in a labour camp for disagreeing with Lysenko, a view shared by the rest of serious Soviet geneticists, though it was not until after the Second World War that Soviet biology was officially committed to the obligatory rejection of genetics, as understood in the rest of the world, at least until after the dictator's demise. The effect of such policies on Soviet science was, predictably, disastrous. Regimes of the National Socialist and Soviet Communist type, utterly different as they were in many respects, shared the belief that their citizens were supposed to assent to a true doctrine, but one formulated and imposed by the secular politico-ideological authorities. Hence the ambiguity and uneasiness about science, which was felt in so many societies, found official expression in such states, unlike in political regimes which were agnostic about their citizens' individual beliefs, as secular governments had learnt to be during the long 19th century. In fact, the rise of regimes of secular orthodoxy was, as we have seen, a byproduct of the age of catastrophe, and they did not last. In any case, the attempt to force science into ideological straitjackets was plainly counterproductive where it was seriously made, as in Soviet biology, or ridiculous where science was left to go its own way, while the superiority of ideology was merely asserted, as in both German and Soviet physics. The official imposition of criteria for scientific theory in the later 20th century was once again left to regimes based on religious fundamentalism. Nevertheless, the uneasiness persisted, not least because science itself became increasingly incredible and uncertain. But until the second half of the century, it was not due to fear of the practical results of science. True, scientists themselves knew better and earlier than anyone else what the potential consequences of their discoveries might be. Ever since the time the first atom bomb became operational, 1945, some of them had warned their masters in government of the destructive forces the world now had at its disposal. Yet the idea that science equals potential catastrophe essentially belonged to the second half of the century. In its first phase, the nightmare of nuclear war, to the era of superpower confrontation after 1945. In its later and more universal phase, to the era of crisis that opened in the 1970s. However, the age of catastrophe, perhaps because it strikingly slowed down world economic growth, was still one of scientific complacency about man's ability to control the powers of nature, or at worst, about nature's ability to adjust to the worst that man could do. On the other hand, what made scientists themselves uneasy then was their own uncertainty about what to make of their theories and findings.